My name's Phil Bevin. I am an independent writer and researcher. I did a PhD in cultural studies from Kingston University, and these days I'm mainly interested in researching the history of the British Empire.
So why do you focus on the British Empire? It's kind of long gone now, really, pretty much the end of the Second World War. It all started to fall apart.
Well, the origin of this actually is I was doing some campaigning, trying to stop an estate from getting demolished, and I used to meet up with my mates beforehand and have a cup of tea, and we were discussing international politics and finance and stuff because we're all quite political, and this old conspiracy theorist came over, and he was interested in what we were talking about, and he showed me a picture of the flag of the East India Company, which if you've seen it, you'll know it's actually quite similar to the flag of the United States. So effectively the US and the English East India Company, which was the originator of the British Empire, have almost the same flag. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I mean, this guy seems a little bit nutty, but there might be something in this, so I'll look into it a bit more. And so I did, and I'm a bit of an obsessive. And so I did look into it, and yeah, there was definitely something in it. And the more I looked into it, the more obvious it was. And so I've set myself this task of proving that we still live in the British Empire, and proving it with primary evidence and mainstream sources so that I don't have to rely on stuff that people can easily dismiss. So I want to make the case, almost kind of from a mainstream point of view.
What you're talking about there is some people call semiotics, which is this whole idea of using symbolism, whether that's in a flag, whether it's in a heraldic crest or something like that. That this symbolism is supposed to mean something to the initiates, to the insiders, but the public look at it, they scratch their heads. Is that, how you see it?
I mean, I don't come at it from a point of view of semiotics, which I did study because I did cultural studies, which is itself an outgrowth of the British Empire, it turns out. But I do think there is, I mean, there's obviously a reason that the founding fathers decided to keep strong elements of the English flag. I haven't quite figured out what that reason is, but I have had a look at documents from the time and sort of the Federalist Papers, which are quite clear that the US federal government is modelled on its predecessor, the English Crown. So not only did they keep large elements of the East India Company flag, they kept large elements of the crown as well when they were transitioning into a republic.
Can you say something about the War of Independence? What was it that actually persuaded the American colonists to take the British on and boot them out? Or should I say
Well,
us?
initially it was taxation. So it was the pressure put on ordinary people basically through taxation. I mean, the trigger was the English East India Company's monopoly on tea. And basically people got
Boston
fed
Tea
up.
Party, yeah?
Yes, the Boston Tea Party. And people just got fed up essentially of funding the British Empire because that's what the United States and the colonies were run for, was to fund the British Empire. And so they set out effectively to become an independent trading nation that wouldn't be reliant upon the British. But there is some evidence that not everybody within the Revolutionary Federalist camp was entirely honest. And there's Sir Benjamin Franklin, for instance, his servant effectively is known to have been a British intelligence asset, and so everything that Benjamin Franklin did was known to the British. And not only that, but there are historians like Richard Deacon, who's written a history of British intelligence services. He actually suggests that Benjamin Franklin, who's really one of the key authors of the US Constitution and the US independence, was himself a British asset. And if you know the history, it was Franklin who went around negotiating the peace with various through various Masonic lodges across Europe. So he was basically using those as conduits for discussions with the establishment, basically.
Well, yeah, because I mean, we forget, don't we, that actually the French were major players in North America.
Yeah, I mean, and this is kind of the where it gets interesting is that, I mean, the independence of the United States, such as it was, following the War of Independence, basically it was an independence of an oligarchy, and a lot of the people within the Federalist camp wanted to keep their wealth that they'd gained from trading with Europe, particularly London. Which is why actually Washington DC, the capital, is the only part of the United States that still is still governed according to English maritime law. It's basically, I think, for that reason, it is so that the standards of legal standards of British remained in force for the leaders of the United States, so they could continue to trade. That's not to say they didn't want independence or a measure of it. And there was competition between those who were like, say, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who were a little bit more aligned to the French because they really wanted true independence from Britain. And this is, we're getting into the kind of the Napoleonic Wars here, like around 1800 to 1812 kind of territory. And they were, so when the Napoleonic Wars started, there was big competition between the British and the French for influence in the in North America, and it came to a head when the British were impounding American shipping in 1812, and President James Madison declared war on Britain. And this, you know, the Napoleonic Wars are going on at the same time, so it's all part of the same, effectively the same, a world war between the British and the French, who are competing for imperial territories.
Yeah, but this is a while
But we
after
don't talk.
independence. Can I just ask you to recycle back a little bit to the East
Yeah,
India
sure.
Company? Describe their flag for us, and because most people would n no idea what the East India Flag Company looks like, and also, you know, what the history and the role was of the East India Company as part of building up the empire.
Of course. So the East India Company flag is the Stars and Stripes, but instead of the stars, you've got the Union flag, the Union Jack. So it's the Union Jack and the stripes. I mean, before that, it was the George Cross, but the East India Company is basically one of the originators of the British Empire. It's the most important one. It started out under Elizabeth I, who granted it trading rights by a royal charter. And all of this came out of the defeat of the Spanish Armada, which gave the English at the time an opening to do overseas trade and in competition with the Spanish, who were the European, big European power at the time. And from that point on, the East India Company grew, especially after they got a foothold in Bengal in India, and they got a trade. They were granted a trading monopoly there by the Crown, and they established what was a for-profit private empire, but it was a for-profit private empire run under the guarantee of the Crown. So the and then again, this gets quite complicated, but it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. But in reality, in this country, in the United Kingdom, and anywhere that is owned, that is where the King of England is sovereign, we don't actually own anything. Everything is freehold. So, which is why you have when you buy a house, you're buying it freehold. So the king has superior ownership over everything. And that was the same back then. So everything that was held by the East India Company as territory or assets was also owned by the Crown. And this is why it's the origin of the British Empire, because even if it's private trading, the king owns all of the assets from that private trade ultimately and can confiscate it. And that's a feudal practice that goes right back. But yeah, that's the origin, and that's why it's the origin of the British Empire, because the East India Company effectively became the empire, held territories in India. And then when we got to the Victorian period, it got nationalized because that's what the crown can do. It could just took basically took it all in-house.
Fascinating. And also, yeah, so this is a sort of almost like an arm's length outsourcing by the royal family, by Elizabeth the First.
Yes, I mean it was outsourced. Yeah, basically, it was you can trade. You have to raise most of the money yourselves, but yeah, and you go and trade. You go and you build up this business, but everything you're doing is in trust for the crown.
If it all goes wrong, you take the blame.
Yeah, if it goes right, then the state has an empire. And so it's like the original sort of private, public-private partnership.
It is, isn't it? Well, look, anyway, back to United States, because obviously the US then became a very, did very well after it set off on a separate route from Britain. But I mean, you're implying there that there was still some sort of, they weren't part of the empire anymore. But was there still a British control in the United States at all or not?
Well, there's always a British influence, mainly centered around the Federalists in New York, even after the Revolution. But the important year, as I mentioned earlier, would be 1812, when President James Madison declared war on Britain, because Britain was confiscating American shipping. Basically, it didn't want the Americans to be sending goods to the French. So the British were confiscating American shipping. And it got so bad that President James Madison came to the conclusion, and he said this, that the United States cannot be an independent country if it can't control its own trade. And at the moment, because of the actions of the British, it doesn't have power over its own trade. And that was the justification for war. The other war aims were also to displace the British from other North American colonies, so Canada, basically, because that had always been a pressure point, where a launching pad for British operations in the United States following independence. So yeah, there was a war between Britain and the United States during the Napoleonic Wars. It was declared by the United States in the interest of gaining freedom to trade without British influence, and the United States lost. And the loss of this war allowed the British effectively to set the boundaries of the United States, but also confirmed British control of American trade, because not only because the Americans had been defeated and Washington burnt to the ground, Napoleon was also defeated. So there was no longer competition between the English and the French for Atlantic trade.
So was
And so with the Treaty
this was
of Ghent.
armies of British soldiers actually on the North American continent doing this, was it?
Yes. Yeah, and they sacked Washington. Yeah, I mean, they were never going to retake the continent, but they did enough damage to cause a lot of problems. The main thing, though, with Britain, always to remember, the important thing is actually is the sea, the navy, because it's about controlling trade routes. And so, even if the British hadn't got anywhere on the American continent, it wouldn't really have mattered that much, because they were going to cut the United States off from being able to trade with anybody. And so control of the Atlantic sea trade is essential to understanding the power of the British Empire, and also the relationship between the United States and Britain. And that's where why the defeat of France is so important, because it gave the English a monopoly on transatlantic trade. And so they could dictate terms to the Americans. And so after, so it was the Treaty of Ghent in 1814. which basically resolved the conflict in Britain's favour, because the Americans obviously wanted freedom of trade, and the Treaty of Ghent didn't deliver that, so it delivered British terms. And after that, you got a huge inflow of investment and money, loans from the Bank of England to industrialize the United States. And so what we now know as the United States, as this major superpower, was actually built on the back of loans from England. Quite literally, it was financed by City of London and the Bank of England. And that is why so many of the major US oligarchs coming out of the 19th century and the early 20th century, which is going to be a controversial claim, but it's just something I've managed to prove without any shadow of a doubt, that they're British assets. So if you're talking about the big industrial oligarchs like the JP Morgan, the Rockefellers, the Astors, to an extent the Carnegies, I think, although I haven't looked into them in any detail, but certainly the Rockefeller, Morgan and Astors, they're all British assets, as in intelligence assets. And they are the ones who, through Standard Oil and United Steel and all these big companies, they basically controlled the US economy. And it was JP Morgan who set up the Federal Reserve. But his family got their money from London. And JP Morgan Jr., who set up the Federal, who, well, with his father, set up the Federal Reserve, was quite literally an agent of MI6.
Oh, well, look, I mean, I'm th from Bristol here. I'm thinking, isn't that interesting that this continent that was so-called discovered, obviously there were millions of Native Americans who already discovered it, but they talk about John Cabot as discovering North America from the European side, sailing out of Bristol in 1498, I think. The Bristol merchant venturers, they were the families that financed Cabot. And then in the next century, in the 1500s, they set up this thing called the Society of Merchant Venturers to exploit this newfound continent. So this all seems to fit. But look, what happened after? I mean, you're talking about the Federal Reserve. In the intervening time between 1812 and the Federal Reserve, you've also got the American Civil War. So I wonder, did the British have a hand in that? And what do you think that was really all about?
I'm still very much looking into that, but I think it was more over the amount of centralization within the American polity. My sense of it, from what I've read so far, is that actually the British took a relative, not a back seat, but they didn't initially back a side. And so what you have, because some people argue that true independence of the United States came with the victory of the North in the Civil War. But actually, if you look at the history of it, the North and South are actually competing for the support of the British, or at least for the British not to intervene on the side of their opponents. So the British could kind of sit back and pick and choose and play divide and rule, basically. And one of the really interesting things I've found out that not a lot of people talk about is that Abraham Lincoln, he wasn't motivated in the Civil War. He wasn't motivated by the abolition of slavery, because that was a relatively late interest for him, really. And actually, it came about because the British were having problems at home in the docks with the working classes not being very happy about basically slave-produced cotton being brought to the UK for manufacture. And so there's a lot of pressure domestically in Britain on the government over slavery. And it was actually the British who put pressure on Abraham Lincoln to end the slave trade. And the reason he did it was to placate the British, because he didn't want them to intervene on the side of the Confederacy. I mean, the other side of that is obviously we in Britain, we like to take credit for the ending of the slave trade, but actually we were really the drivers of the slave trade after we abolished it in the British Empire. We continued it until the 19th century and the American Civil War, at which point we then abolished it. By putting pressure on Abraham Lincoln, because
Well, I mean,
he
it
had
does
a lot of
rather
economic
annoy me. I
interests as
see
well.
a lot of stuff nowadays about, oh, we're against modern slavery. And then, of course, you see people camped in tents outside the Bristol benefit office. The idea, of course, is that slavery is something that can be enforced through the nudge unit and through taking away your ability to feed yourself. And through economic means. But anyway, look, back to the States and the Federal Reserve. A lot of people talk about this as a sort of privatization of US banking, a bit like when they set up the Bank of England as a central bank, which was under the control of the state. And I mean, this is could be a good thing, it could be a bad thing. The last thing you want is a private bank which is just milking the entire economy for its own personal benefit. So what do you make of the advent of the Federal Reserve?
Well, I mean, the driving force behind the Federal Reserve was J.P. Morgan and his family, who got their wealth from Britain, and it came off the back of the 1907 financial crisis in the U.S. But my view is that the Federal Reserve was created. Really, as a means of centralizing the US economy to the benefit of the City of London. So, in the US, you had all these kind of regional banks, which was a pretty unstable system that could lend money and things. And so, with the Federal Reserve, what they did is it was the start of a process of centralization to bring the economy under government control. But bear in mind that the kind of the major player within the Federal Reserve is the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is the base for JP Morgan, who is an MI6 agent. And actually, the Federal Reserve system, it's not a state bank in the same way as the Bank of England. So, again, this is getting into the weeds a bit, but I think it's quite important. So, when it comes to the Bank of England, as I mentioned earlier, all the assets held by private individuals and everything in this country, in the UK, and wherever the King of England is sovereign, is ultimately owned by the King of England. So the Bank of England can print money, and ultimately that money is guaranteed by the state. So that's the origin of quantitative easing.
I mean, hang on, because
And
are you talking here about my garden or my car and
yes. Oh yeah,
my not
absolutely.
my teapot as well?
Yeah, your teapot. It's all owned by the King of England. The technical term is superior ownership. So you know all that stuff, you've got freehold. But it's a freehold. It's not actually, it's kind of a form of tenancy. It's not actually ownership.
Right, okay.
So the microphone I'm using for this conversation is owned by the King of England. And although, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't confiscate it, if he wanted to, he could.
Interesting. Yeah,
And
this is a
that is the legal framework of this
sounds like
country.
worse than
And
Saudi Arabia.
I don't know about Saudi Arabia. But it's a feudal law. It just is. It's the way it works. And actually, it gives a lot of stability and a lot of confidence to the English system, because you know where you stand with it. Because actually, the King of England is guarantor of the financial regulation and all this kind of stuff. So it's so long standing that it gives people a lot of confidence and to invest in the economy.
Well, yeah, so
But
there's
in
a different
terms of
system in the States. Is that what you're saying? Under Federal Reserve, and it's a different system
yeah,
then.
oh yeah, it's the States is completely different, and it derives from the different. The land ownership there, which is so in the United States, if you live in one of the states, you can actually own land depending on state laws and stuff. You can own it. We can't own it in this country. The king owns it. But in the United States, you can own it. From the point of view of the British, historically speaking, that's not good, because if you have people who actually own their own land and their own resources, then they can be economically independent, and that is why you have the federal government. And the federal government exists basically to subjugate and extract the wealth from the population of the United States. So they rely on the federal government, which is really a colonial overseer working on behalf of the City of London. And that goes back to the Treaty of Ghent, but there's quite plenty of other stuff since then that have kind of reinforced that.
Well, I mean, you're starting to get into some interesting territory here about who's really, because one of the questions we're always asking is who's in charge. I mean, quite obviously, the whole world does look at Britain slightly askance. You know, we've created this monster of America that seems to have decided it can march into any country that it wants to, that took hold of a whole load of Nazis at the end of the Second World War, brought them in to build the space program and all this sort of stuff, as well as creating at the end of the Second World War, creating the State of Israel. So, you know, Britain, we've got this Anglo-Zionist Empire, people call it, which is, you know, a system of largely influence, but obviously some projecting military power, intelligence, satellite intelligence, this sort of thing around the world. But can you say something about that Anglo-Zionist Empire and, you know, basically where is it being run from? What's it being run for? This sort of thing.
Well, personally, I de-emphasize the Zionist a little bit because I don't think, in terms of imperial grand strategy, although there is definitely an influence, I don't think Israel is that important. I think there's a bit of a myth growing up around that. And hopefully I'll be able to come back round to why I think that. It's certainly a player, and there's a lot of integration between the intelligence services.
Okay,
But
sure. So
I would say,
let's focus on Britain and the United States then.
yes, well, I mean, I would say that it's not. I would say that it's the British Empire. I don't even think it's the American Empire. I think it's the British Empire.
Well, no, hang on, because surely what the Brits are doing is being, I mean, largely run by, you know, I mean, look at, for example, just simple things like the introduction of mayors all across Britain. This is an American policy. Surely we're just following under the coattails of the big powerful Americans who, you know, who are our overlords, really.
Well, they're certainly not our overlords. I mean, the way I look at it, and like I said before at the beginning of this conversation, I'm trying to prove a case through primary source evidence and kind of mainstream stuff. So when I'm looking at the US Empire, such as it is, I'm looking for, well, what does the US Empire, what does the US actually own? Well, if you look at the figures in terms of land ownership, well, the US government doesn't actually own all of its own territory because of the way ownership works, as I was talking about. Quite a lot of it is privately held by oligarchs, really, not by ordinary people. Most of it's held by oligarchs. And so, okay, so the US doesn't actually have much in the way of land assets. Okay, so what about other assets, financial assets? Well, if you look at the dollar trade, for instance, I think Wall Street trades around 17 to 19% of the world dollar trade. It processes that. City of London does 38 to 44%. So twice as City of London trades twice as many dollars as the United States itself does. And if you take into account the ownership laws and rules around Britain and the Crown territories, that means that at any one point in time, the King of England owns more dollars than the US government.
Well, yeah, but what does that actually prove in terms of day-to-day power? Surely the Americans are, you know, a massive military. They're projecting influence and power around the world, where the Britain is a kind of, well, we're a has-been, aren't we? Let's be frank about it.
What you're proposing here is you're looking at it from the point of view of individual nation states, and as a nation state, the United States is incredibly powerful. Well, at least that's the way it appears. But I'm talking about an international empire, which goes back hundreds of years, and the kind of the I think a good definition of an empire is a state that is made up of an imperial state that's made up of a number of different nations. And so if you're looking at, say, the Crown today, You're looking at the territories of Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and various other places across the world as tax havens and things. But territorially, and this is territory literally owned by the King of England, you're looking at a sixth of the Earth's land surface. Now, if you compare that to the territories owned by the United States doesn't actually own very much at all. It's piddling. It's nothing. And this isn't actually my working out. I should reference Kevin Cahill, who was a researcher in the House of Lords and also was a researcher for the Sunday Times Rich List. So he's a mainstream guy who knows what he's talking about. And also I've checked this out. And literally, yes, the King of England owns a sixth of the Earth's land surface. You're also talking about most of the world's dollar supply. And in terms of the way the Federal Reserve works, just to unpack that a bit, is that the Federal Reserve is essentially, it's a private bank. There's a certain percentage that US banks within the Federal Reserve system and their private banks have to put aside to essentially bankroll the Federal Reserve. And so the US government is dependent very much on private finance. And if there isn't much growth in the financial system, then there's less money to go around. And in terms of international finance, the entity that has, well, the entities that have the most leverage in international finance are the Bank of England and the City of London. And it's also worth pointing out that a lot of, as I mentioned earlier, that a lot of US land is privately owned by oligarchs. Where are they storing their wealth? Well, I don't know for certain, but I would hazard an educated guess that their investments follow the general trend, which would be, between 38 and 44% stored in London or registered tax havens. And we don't know exactly how much really is stored in British tax havens because we don't have the figures. So basically, you're looking at the United States, most of its assets are almost certainly, and actually, the other thing with the United States, it's foreign held debt. People talk about the Japan and China owning being the biggest owners of US debt. That's not true. The largest owner by far of US debt, international debt, is the Crown. And that's all you have to do is add up the Crown territories that hold large amounts of US debt. The Cayman Islands holds a surprisingly large amount. So in terms of US debt, in terms of international holders of US debt, the Crown is the biggest. And so basically the US is pretty much mostly owned, I think, or to a large extent owned by the Crown. And if you think also about the Federal Reserve and US debt, the other, when we take international debt and other international countries out of the equation, the biggest holder of US debt is the private sector. And again, and like what I said earlier, when it comes to the private sector, I expect that the investments follow the general trend, which means the Crown probably has a controlling share in that as well.
Probably.
Well, almost certainly, because you just look at the percentages, it can't be otherwise, logically speaking. But I mean, I've written about this at length, so I
Yeah,
mean,
okay.
it's quite
Could
hard. It's harder to
you
explain
just
in a
tell us
podcast than it is.
whereabouts? Where can people find and follow your stuff, Phil?
Yeah, so it's my research is published on Patreon, and my handle is a different narrative.
Look, you've done a sort of almost like an audit here, looking at whereabouts this wealth is held. But what about the, individuals that are actually controlling it, and alliances, specific groups, that sort of thing, that manage it?
Yeah, well, if you talked about the English East India Company earlier, and so basically it's the same premise but expanded massively. So you have these private corporate entities that essentially run the empire at arm's length in the interests of the crown. So, you know, when you talk about corporate lobbying and influence over the US, you're really kind of talking about British influence, because the system is set up and run in order to benefit the British. And I'm going to roll back a bit, because you asked me to talk about how the British could possibly control the United States. And there's people like Matthew Ayrett who've done studies of a lot of intelligence influence and stuff. But again, like I said, I'm looking at documentary material evidence. And really, you just need to look at the treaties and the history of the treaties. So, for example, the Treaty of Brussels, which established NATO and the European Union, which are really kind of the same thing. That was a British initiative. President Roosevelt didn't want to have a permanent troop presence, a US troop presence in Europe. He was very much against it. He then died, and Truman came in, surrounded by people like Avril Harriman and Churchill's influence in the State Department. And Avril Harriman was a close friend of Churchill, basically a British asset. And if what you had is they effectively set up this, these treaties like NATO, which would ensure that the US would guarantee the US Army, the US Navy, would guarantee the continuation of British, the security of British territories and British assets in the face of the supposed threat from the Soviet Union. And so it's all been engineered. And it's, I mean, the point that I want to kind of emphasize here is don't underestimate the influence of the JP Morgans and the Rockefellers. These were the guys who owned Standard Oil and United Steel. They basically controlled the US economy. And the US government was beholden to them. And even someone like President Roosevelt, who did resist the British, had very, very strong connections with them. So he would, during his earlier career, he was a frequenter of the British Embassy. He visited the Astor family, the Cliveden set at their residence. They seem to be a very important bunch, effectively power brokers. So it's no real surprise that Roosevelt went to pay court to them. Now, there's a very good historian, very well renowned historian, academic, Carol Quigley, who was actually a mentor to Bill Clinton. He taught Bill Clinton at university and was very influential. Now, Quigley was sort of on the edges of this group, this organization called the Round Table, which was set up by British imperialists. I mean, originally, it dates back to the Confession of Faith of Cecil Rhodes and his Will and Testament, where he set up the Rhodes Trust and the Rhodes Scholarships. And the person who managed the Rhodes Scholarships was Lord Alfred Milner, who would go on to be a British colonial secretary. And again, this is all publicly available stuff. But Quigley points out, and he was himself quite close to the Round Table. He points out that the Round Table and the Cliveden set were basically effectively interchangeable. They were the same thing. And we shouldn't underestimate the importance of the Round Table, because the Round Table was really the power behind the Chamberlain government of the 1930s. And because one of the key people within that movement was it was Neville Chamberlain, but it was also his father, Joseph Chamberlain, as well. And Joseph Chamberlain was close to Cecil Rhodes, close to Milner, and he was colonial secretary while Milner was governor of South Africa. So it goes back a fair way.
Now, look, I hate to interrupt you, but I ought to say something about Rhodes, because he's well known to have believed that in the late 1800s that the British Empire was powerful. It was still being extended, and he believed that if they played their cards right, that Britain could actually take over the world. Is that right?
Yes, it is right. I mean that, but the thing is, that's not just Cecil Rhodes, that's also Winston Churchill and quite a lot of the British elite. But yeah, I mean, Cecil Rhodes is effectively the founder of the Round Table, and the Round Table is what created, well, it's not just what created, it is. The Round Table is, these days, it is manifest in various think tanks. So Chatham House and the Council on Foreign and Council on Foreign Relations, these huge, massively influential think tanks are the Roundtable movement. And so you also have groups like the I'm trying to think of it. it's the Trilateral Commission. So a lot of the groups associated with the Rockefeller family, because the Rockefeller family were members and financiers of the Round Table, also members of this club called the United Empire Club. They did speeches. Member of the Rockefeller family, I think it's David Rockefeller, did speeches to the Canadian branch of the United Empire Club.
Ah, right. So the United Empire Clubs, I mean, that's something I've not come across before. Do they actually have physical clubs like in St. James's in London and other places around the world?
There is one in London. Whether it's a physical premises these days, I don't know, but it still exists. There's one in London and there's one in Canada. And it's to the Canadian branch that David Rockefeller spoke. But going way back, because the Rockefellers obviously, they got their fortune as the founders of the Standard Oil Company. One of the co-founders, a Scottish man whose name escapes me for the moment, it was also was a member of the London-based United Empire Club, and the kind of the founding charter of all branches of the United Empire Club is the loyalty to the British Empire and its success. So again, you've got the Rockefellers who are part of this international, basically British imperial. The transatlantic British Imperial Network that went on to found the kind of the neo-conservative, neoliberal, the big think tanks that we all think of today as the drivers of US foreign policy. And if you look at US foreign policy doctrine, as it's been articulated also by things like the Atlantic Council, which again ties into all this stuff, you realize that it actually is basically one to one with British imperial foreign policy dating back to the 19th century. And you mentioned Cecil Rhodes. So basically, what happened at the end of the 19th century was the British were worried because Germany, the German states unified under Bismarck and Kaiser Wilhelm I. So you had, for the first time, a unified Imperial Germany that was outproducing the British in steel and other products. And so what you had was the possibility of either a war between Britain and Germany, which would be disastrous, or you would have the eclipse of the British Empire by a Germany that could unite, potentially through force, because we're talking about Prussian militarism, and that's how the German Empire united, that could unite the European continent, which would effectively could dominate trading routes across the Atlantic. And much like the competition between the British and Napoleon 100 years earlier, they were worried about the same thing with Germany. And so that's one of the reasons they started to try and really consolidate the British Empire, and that's what the Round Table was all about. Part of this project was also to incorporate Germany into the British Empire, and I'm now touching upon the prehistory of the European Union, because there were negotiations between a King Edward the Seventh, I think it was, and Frederick the Third. I think it's Frederick the Third, who was the father of Kaiser Wilhelm the Second. Basically, the idea was to incorporate, is to allow the Germans to have their a German empire on the continent, but was within the envelope of British imperial power across the Atlantic. So it was an empire that would unite Britain, the United States, and the European continent under German management in a single greater British empire, basically. And the British wanted to achieve this without a war. That is why we had the policies of appeasement through the Chamberlain government, which really did want to. Some people say that, you know, the British were really not that interested in avoiding the war and actually wanted it. No, they didn't want the Second World War. They didn't want the First World War. They wanted to pursue this greater British Empire by negotiation with Germany. Frederick III, had he lived more than like 90 days or something, probably would have facilitated it. Kaiser Wilhelm II was less keen, and so we got the wars effectively. But the result of the wars was British victory, and we got this greater British Empire that had been planned since the 19th century through German defeat. And one of the important documents pertaining to this is the London Agreement of 1953. And this is really the final signing off of the euro dollar market, which is the flow of dollars from the United States to Europe via London and you know, basically the Marshall Plan. And it integrated the economies. The British and the US economy had always been integrated because of the slave trade and cotton that was then used in textile manufacturing in the UK. But this brought the Western Europe into the fold as well, making Germany as kind of the industrial engine of the Western European Union, subservient to, I mean, literally constitutionally subservient to British power, because the London Agreement of 1953 is explicit that Germany does not have an independent economic policy. It's not that it doesn't have an independent foreign policy, even. It doesn't have an independent foreign policy. West Germany, sorry, I'm talking about. And West Germany is obviously now reunified Germany. It's the same state, basically. So it didn't have an independent foreign policy, but it also didn't have an independent domestic economic policy. So West Germany, until 1991, formally, and probably since as well, but officially until 1991, could not sign off on its own economic policy. It all had to be agreed by the Allied powers, predominantly London, which is where the agreement was signed. And again, it's publicly available. If you Google the London Agreement of 1953, you'll find it and you can read it, and it's there.
I mean, it's astounding stuff you're saying, and obviously this is not covered really by university historians or anyone like that, and certainly not by the mainstream press. But what you're describing is almost medieval sounding. It's like a kind of aristocratic Holy Roman Empire operating and these treaties. And of course, you know, anyone that looks into it will know that it is your head of state, your royalty, that get involved in treaty signing, and you know that sets the backdrop against which all of the electoral politics operates on. So, is it fair to sort of say that there is still this powerful landowning aristocracy at the heart of affairs in Europe and America?
Yes, although again, sort of deferring to Kevin Cahill, who wrote the book, and it's called "Who Owns the World," and I recommend that everyone reads it because it is just factual. It lists who owns the world in terms of the land holdings that they have, and by far, I mean, it was written obviously while the Queen was still alive. So, you know, for him, he was saying that by far the greatest landowner in the world, by far, there is no competition. Or even close, it is the crown. So it was then the Queen of England, and now the King of England. Land holdings haven't really changed much. So yeah, it is quite literally a feudal aristocracy, and he kind of makes that point. But he's right about the ownership, because I've checked it out myself constitutionally. He is correct. So I think it's something like a sixth of the Earth's land surface is literally owned by the King of England. And so all these treaties, what the United States, the role of the United States military in the United States as a territory or a group of territories even, is essentially to support the British Empire, and by which I mean the infrastructure built around the territorial holdings of the King of England and the financial infrastructure of the City of London, which is the heart, still very much the centre of global trade.
I mean, it's quite secretive, the City of London, and it's w weirdly archaic. I remember reading something on the BBC website recently about a whistleblower from one of the City of London livery companies who was saying, "Well, actually, we're nothing to do with the, well, very little to do with the charitable side of this old trade that's been, you know, it's been around since medieval times. Now, obviously, most of those trades have gone because so much trade has gone from Britain, you know, the expertise in manufacturing, that sort of thing." And he was hinting really that that there was an enormous amount of financial power swilling around these old livery companies. I wonder what do you make of the sort of mechanism by which the City of London operates nowadays?
Well, I'm not sure about the old livery companies. That's not something I've looked into, and as you say, it's quite opaque, so I probably wouldn't find much. But I will have a look. But really, it's the foreign exchange markets, and it's the dollar, the euro dollar market. So the euro dollar market was set up in the late 1940s, and it was set up by Avril Harriman, who I've mentioned previously. He was British. He was the American ambassador to Britain. He's also semi-family to Winston Churchill. He married Churchill's former daughter-in-law, Pamela, who became Pamela Harriman. Very good friends. If you read A Rendezvous with Destiny, which is Eliot Roosevelt's one of two biographies Eliot Roosevelt did of his father, FDR, he says that Harriman was effectively working for Churchill. He also makes a point that the US State Department was working for Churchill, and actually he quotes his father saying that at the time. So within the United States during the Second World War, you had forces very much working for the British interest, and actually that included the CIA, which was set up by MI6 and by a guy. It was originally called the OSS, and it was set up by another colleague of Churchill's called William Stevenson. Who is also very closely associated with the Cliveden Set and the Round Table, because one of his core assets was Vincent Astor, who was related to the Astors, who were the kind of people organizing the Cliveden Set and funding the Round Table. But going back to the Second World War, so all of this kind of stuff, a lot of it, although Roosevelt was himself resisting it, a lot of the post-war infrastructure was set up by Churchill and his allies, his assets within the US government during the war, and then put into practice after Roosevelt's death. So I know that Michael Hudson, who's a fairly prominent economist on the left, has said that the euro dollar market came out of the Suez crisis. And there's a documentary that's been doing the rounds, which is one of the things that kind of fed into this interest of mine as well. It's called The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire. But although it is very interesting, it gets quite a lot of things right. The premise of it is false because it says that it was after the Suez Crisis and British imperial decline that they decided to set up tax havens and things. But I've looked into it, and actually, they're talking about the euro dollar market coming about in the late 50s. Actually, it was started in the early 50s off the back of the Marshall Plan, and actually, the Marshall Plan was set up to establish the flow of dollars into Europe via London. And there are debates about it in the House of Commons. You can find them on Hansard. So you've got during the Second World War, the British were purposefully setting up the financial infrastructure for the post-war period, and they were going to make the United States bankroll the British Empire in the future. And as I said previously, I actually think that the establishment of the Federal Reserve, the further consolidation and centralization of US banking following the 1929 Wall Street crash, which many people argue was triggered by JP Morgan, were actually setting up the dollar to become the world reserve currency in the post-war period.
Yeah,
it
but
wasn't a
so
smooth sailing.
how do you justify things like something like the Suez Crisis? Because this was the Americans basically undermining the Brits. Were the Brits undermining themselves? What are you saying?
My knowledge of it is limited because I haven't got that far yet. I'm still kind of focusing around the 19th century and the Second World War at the moment, but I have looked into it, and it's not nearly as big a deal as people say, from what I can gather. Also, from what I've read, and this is, includes from Anthony Eden's own account of it, is that really what you're looking at is the US and Britain sharing strategic aims, but the empire as a whole, including within the Commonwealth, being split on the tactics. So it's not a difference of imperial strategy. It's a difference of how you go about it. And it seems to have been, from what I understand, the US trying to extricate and preserve Britain's reputation after Britain really screwed up, and basically going ahead and being a little bit too obvious about its role as an imperial power.
Right, and I suppose also you could argue that if Britain still has quite a control over the United States, the idea is it's a cover. You know, your new empire that's emerging after the war is under remote control. You know, the Americans are being manipulated by the Brits, but still the control is coming from the royal family and European aristocracy of the States this time, rather than just the Brits.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's my hunch. Like I said, I need to look into it further, but my hunch is the same thing, is the same idea, because if you look at the way the Commonwealth was developing, you had this narrative that was put forward by the British themselves that basically the empire was retreating voluntarily. And this was because, obviously, the British had just fought a war and won a war against Nazi Germany, which is very overtly racist, along similar lines, actually, to people like Lord Milner of the Round Table, who was very much described himself as an English race patriot. So what the British were trying to do was disassociate themselves from this idea of race-based imperialism with which they'd always previously been associated. But it wasn't. They did that whilst trying to maintain, and successfully, in my view, trying to maintain the empire. And they did it through institutions like, obviously, the Commonwealth, but also the United Nations, which really was built out of the empire as well, which is something that doesn't get enough discussion.
No, I
The UN,
mean, do you
again,
know much
is a
about the
product of.
origins of the Commonwealth? I mean, it seemed to me, looking, historically looking at it, that it was just the idea is, well, we've lost our empire, but we can still have a little bit of a club.
No, I mean that's the myth. That's the myth that the British themselves propagated. So the Commonwealth came into being. Wait, the Commonwealth is the empire. Is the historic British Empire. It's just literally, legally, constitutionally, it's the same thing. The Commonwealth formally came into being, as in people started referring to the empire as a Commonwealth, with the Statute of Westminster in 1931. Now, I don't think there's anybody, any serious historians or anybody sensible who would suggest that 1931 was when the British Empire collapsed. But that is the date of the Commonwealth. And actually, the idea goes even further back than that. And it was originally proposed by Milner again. I think it came up at the Imperial Conference of 1926. So a lot of the issues that led to the supposed imperial decline were actually recognized beforehand by the Round Table. And they put into place measures to offset the dangers of imperial decline purposely. They did it on purpose. And again, the readouts from the Imperial Conference of 1926 are publicly available. They talk about establishing the Commonwealth of Nations, the British Commonwealth, making special provision for India, which has always had kind of a sort of a strange constitutional position within the empire as an empire unto itself. And so the Commonwealth was the empire, and Churchill in his speeches during the war refers to the Commonwealth as the empire. The two are interchangeable. It's not that the empire collapsed and now we have this club. It's the empire never collapsed. And it's important to recognize that you have the various Commonwealth declarations. Well, I mean, the adherence to the Commonwealth is enacted in law in all of the countries involved. So it's actually it has a legislative presence. They are bound by their own legal system to follow the edicts of Commonwealth declarations. So what you've got is it's not quite, but it's something like a federal empire that was envisioned by the Round Table early on, that is run through the Commonwealth Secretariat, and is headed by the King.
Well, look, I mean, is it as simple as this is now some sort of financial or intelligence empire, which no one really kind of notices, rather than a military empire? The Commonwealth is a, what's the difference between the what we would consider the old-fashioned British Empire, where we're, Britannia's ruling the waves, and this new Commonwealth that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, it's understanding the question. So when you say the old British Empire, I suppose you're probably referring to the period of direct rule from Westminster, which was, I can't remember the exact date, but
Well,
it's
yeah,
during
but
the
I mean, it's
Victorian
the Royal
period.
Navy, largely the Royal Navy, dominating trade, dominating these countries, Britain directly deciding who is going to be in charge of the judicial system, who's going to be running that country. What's the system now, which is behind the scenes? What's going on with this Commonwealth that you still think of as an empire?
Well, the so when you're talking about direct rule, which is what you're referring to there, you're talking about a relatively short period of the British Empire's history. Originally, as I mentioned earlier, the British Empire was outsourced to things like the East India Company and the Royal African Company. It was run at arm's length via private corporations. And the direct rule period is actually something of an aberration, and my view is that we've gone back to something more or less like the original East India Company style model, but with more checks and balances in place. So things like the United Nations are set up to deliberately push back on some of the excesses and to regulate imperial governance. And so what you have, and in terms of military, there is a treaty and numerous treaties between the United States and various constituent members of the empire to defend them. The United the there it is still a military empire. It's just that it's been outsourced to the U.S. Military and U.S. Navy. As the English East India Company at its height had a military an army that was bigger than the English army. It's very similar principles. It's arm's length, run partially through corporate finance, but also through all these various different bodies established by the Round Table and regulated by the United Nations. It's all very much the same empire. It's absolutely massive. And the main reason we did transition from direct rule, and again, quoting Alfred Milner a lot, but he's very relevant because he was the leader of the Round Table, was that basically, in his view anyway, British parliamentarians, elected parliamentarians, weren't making very good decisions because they didn't really understand the imperial issues, the scope and scale that was necessary, which is why there's been more emphasis placed on regional self-governance. So you have individual nations like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Jamaica, who have they have independent government within a financial and geopolitical system, an envelope of the empire. So they don't actually have freedom to determine their own foreign policy or really their own financial policy, and which is one of the things of the Commonwealth. It is it did originally and still does, I think, specify the need for free trade, which effectively means the system running through London. That they have a measure of local democratic freedom, as do we, but they don't have freedom to determine their fate vis-a-vis the empire.
Given all this, okay, what I mean, we're in Britain now. We're living through a rather horrible time where living standards are being driven down, children are being driven into poverty, the basic in you know things like the basic infrastructure of the country is now being privatised, and they are through energy prices, through transport prices, etc. They are just impoverishing the nation. It seems as if the lobbying of the current administration, as well as we're not making party political points here, it's really just identical to the previous Conservative government, is being done by these very very powerful corporations who now control our infrastructure. So that isn't very good for the home country of the Commonwealth. I just wondered if you've thought at all about how to break this system and how we might go back to a much more democratic, that is, the people ruling, and more social equality. Because, I mean, the party that's doing very well may possibly even form the next government, Reform, doesn't really have hardly any social policies whatsoever. And yet that seems to be at the heart of what is wrong in modern Britain. So, how can we address the issues that you've been raising about the lack of actual democratic accountability?
It's very difficult because there never has been democratic accountability, and the democratic accountability that we have had has been one, limited, and or two, an illusion. The is I mean the only because also I mean the other I'm not trying to. Two negatives here. I think there is a potential solution, but the you've got to bear in mind, and again, this is a key point I wanted to raise. I can't remember if I raised it already, but the reason we have the British Empire is actually geography. So what was that England, which is now the British Isles, or Britain, Scotland, and Northern Ireland are it's a relatively small territory with a middling population. And actually, our resources aren't that great. It was the break with Rome and the break with continental Europe under Catholicism that put us in a particular predicament, in the sense that as a breakaway Protestant country, England had to be able to defend itself. And the defeat of the Spanish Armada gave it an opening to do overseas trade. The reason we have an empire is because without having a navy, that is more than equal to our nearest continental rival. As a nation, we are very susceptible to blockade and starvation because we can't feed ourselves. We import everything. So that has to be borne in mind when you're talking about going against an international empire that exists in order to preserve the British state by ensuring imports. So, first and foremost, as an island, no man is an island, and all that, we can't survive on our own. That's just geography. It's also, demographics and things. As a nation, the British nation cannot survive isolated. It has to be linked to other nations in the world, basically the Commonwealth. So, my first point would be you have to preserve the remnants of the empire in some form or fashion. If Britain is to, there's an easier solution if you want Britain to collapse. But I mean, if I think any political party or anybody who is putting that to the British electorate, vote for me and you'll starve, is going to struggle. So you're looking at preserving some of the relationships we already have, but on a more equitable basis, which means, to my mind, some form of collective commitment to investing, to investment across the Commonwealth. You've also got a whole issue here of you've got a corporate empire run by private finance with various different tax havens. Facilitating capital flight from one nation to another. So, if one nation elects the wrong government, an economist I know has suggested it's a bit like the Death Star. You just pointed at the country that's elected the wrong government, and their economy collapses, and the government collapses, and immediately they elect, the right person, quote in quotation marks. So, you've got
You're
to
so
tackle
sounding like you're
capital
talking
flight.
about Li you sounds like you're talking about Liz Truss.
Not really, no. I mean, possibly, not specifically. But yeah, I mean, that was an example of it, I guess. So you've got to account for that. And so it's very, very difficult. It is recognizing that we need, as a country, we need an international system to survive, but it's moving that system away from an extractivist one to one based on investment while maintaining the source of credit that is necessary for that investment. I think the funny thing is that capital flight would be really easy to deal with if you could control the asset of last resort, as it were, which is the crown. Because in a sense, in the City of London system, capital has nowhere else to go. If it runs from the UK to the Cayman Islands, well, the Cayman Islands are still a Crown territory, and the wealth can still be confiscated and reinvested back into the well-being of the general populace. But how do you engineer the crown? How do you get to a point where you're using the crown as a mechanism for investment, not extraction? And that's
So,
kind of the problem I'm working on.
yeah. Well, do you
There's
think
no
King
easy answers,
Charles?
basically, but I am thinking about it.
Yeah, does King Charles understand any of this, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, the monarch is a fairly sort of reactive power. They kind of exist to prevent change rather than to create it. But I think Charles, my sense, and this is not really, I try and base all my stuff on documents, evidence, and facts. This is not based on that. This is just my interpretation. Is that I think probably he has a pretty good understanding of things and is probably more progressively minded. But he is King Charles, and he is the monarch, and his priority is the preservation of the empire. So as it currently stands, so he can. He might, and I think he possibly has, if my reading of the last King's speech is anything to go by, lent on various governments to listen to people and kind of listen to concerns and respond. But he wouldn't dismantle the financial system as it exists. And the reality is the It's the reason there was the Glorious Revolution, and we got William of Orange as kids, is that if you have a king that doesn't go the way that the international oligarchy wants, they can, even though he is the first among equals, they can club together and get rid of him. And that was, again, that was because I think it was James II was a Catholic or suspected of being a Catholic. I'm a bit
Well,
fuzzy
he
on the
had Catholic
detail, but.
leanings, yeah. But I don't think there's any chance of that with Charlie. I mean, he seems to sort of be one of those people who will definitely go with the flow of whatever international finance is hinting, including this whole sort of reset that we're getting towards digitization and financialization of nature, which is, a big change is going on in the international financial system through COP and net zero. But anyway, look, can you just please quickly wind up with places that people can follow you again, please, and any articles,
Yes,
specific articles?
so if you didn't find that already too depressing, so really the only place I'm I am at the moment is on Patreon, and my handle is A Different Narrative. So look for me on Patreon. It's a page full of stuff about the British Empire, peppered with bad artwork. So you can find me there. But yes, I mean it's you'll learn stuff that is very much true, but you won't have learned at school,
Okay,
basically.
you
It's the
mentioned
world does
Michael
not have.
Hudson. Do you want to just name
Yes.
one other economist or writer that you think is well worth a look at?
At the moment, I think Steve Hall is pretty good, very good actually. Someone I know, in fact, and I've been talking to him a bit, and his understanding of the way finance works is in my view, basically correct.
Phil Bevin, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.